The practice of medicine is an art, not a trade, a calling, not a business, a calling in which your heart will be exercised equally with your head. Often the best part of your work will have nothing to do with potions and powders, but with the exercise of an influence of the strong upon the weak, of the righteous upon the wicked, or the wise upon the foolish. To you, as the trusted family counselor, the father will come with his anxieties, the mother with her hidden grief, the daughter with her trials, and the son with his follies. The physician needs a clear head and a kind heart. Those are some comments by famous physician Sir William Osler in the late 1800s. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
How has the role of the physician changed over time? Does the Hippocratic Oath need revision? How have changing notions of the body influenced the practice of medicine and our concept of a doctor's vocation? Joining us to explore the history of the physician is Thomas Broman, History of Science professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
I suppose before we get into specific physicians in history, we might look at some of the evidence, anonymous, of surgical practice, let's say, in archaeological terms. What do we find?
There's actually a long surgical treatise from Egypt known as the, there's two famous papyri. One is the Ebers Papyrus and the other is the name I'm blanking on. But one is about surgical treatment of wounds. And what you find in that is that there's a fair bit of evidence for bone setting, of course. There are procedures for amputation. They know a lot about how to stitch up various kinds of complicated wounds. They can reset dislocated joints. They can also treat certain kinds of abscesses, which might need to be closed up. So already in the most recorded, in the most ancient written records, there's plenty of evidence of some knowledge of surgical techniques.
Is there any evidence of science of pain relief along the way with that?
There's also a great deal of knowledge about analgesics in botanical literature, so that one would know how to use opium, for example. That knowledge goes back to antiquity. Other kinds of analgesics come from various plants. So, yeah, there would be pain relief as well.
And what about concepts of the doctor? I mean, we picture a doctor today. We think of the white coat with a stethoscope around the neck and so on. What kinds of images of doctors, what sorts of ideas of the status of doctors do we find if we go back to ancient times?
That's quite variable. So that one finds in Egypt, for example, that the priests were also healers. That is, the most socially elevated priests were also ones who tended to be most involved as educated healers. And the reason for that is because written texts were sacred, treated as sacred objects in ancient Egyptian civilization. On the other hand, there's plenty of evidence that there were healers in every society who are not necessarily even literate, that they have knowledge of botanicals, they have knowledge of various surgical techniques or, you know, fairly simple surgical techniques. Midwives have been present forever, so that you have a variety of healers. In fact, one of the things I find most interesting to get students to think about in my teaching is to think about healing as a kind of universal activity, and that the healers exist in every society for the simple reason that there's always suffering, and healers exist to do two things. One is to relieve the suffering. People always want to feel better, it seems to me. And secondly, they also exist to explain the nature of the suffering, and that can be religious or it can be naturalistic. And those two functions are always present among all healers.
What about the Hippocratic Oath, you know, the do no harm and so on? What's known about that and this notion that a doctor has to treat patients' information with confidentiality?
That's an interesting question. The oath is a fairly late addition to the Hippocratic corpus. It only appeared in history long after the supposed lifetime of Hippocrates, the historical figure. What the oath tells it's and it's not even clear what the context for the oath is. Was it taken in as a swearing-in ceremony as it is now? Probably not. It could have been used as a kind of marketing document, that is, a way of identifying a certain group of healers as being of this group. And in a society where there would have been lots of competing healers, that might have been a way of saying, we're healers of this kind who have this certain kind of profession, who take our profession as a kind of holy calling, who use a certain kind of set of techniques. But the actual context for the oath is not very evident at all.
Is Hippocrates the first named physician that we come across historically?
No. There's actually evidence of physicians slightly older than Hippocrates who practiced in the Persian court, although his name escapes me at the moment. But Hippocrates is one of the earliest.
And what do we know about Hippocrates as a doctor, if he's kind of one of the early figures standing as a representation for what physicians might be like?
There was a family of practitioners on the island of Kos who were known as both practitioners of healing and teachers of medicine. And Hippocrates comes from that group of physicians. One of the things we know comes from Plato's dialogue Protagoras, where Socrates inquires of a fellow named Hippocrates, not the historical figure, if he were to study medicine, if he were to study medicine and teach it in the variety, in the form of his namesake Hippocrates, would he then want to do it for money? So we know from Plato, who lived slightly after Hippocrates, that Hippocrates, or who was a younger contemporary of Hippocrates, that Hippocrates taught healing for money. We also know there were some unattributed records from his son about Hippocrates' travels on the mainland of Greece, not much more than that.
And what did Hippocrates do or write or say that makes his reputation endure?
That's a very good question. Hippocrates' reputation is probably best known because of the advocacy of Galen, the Roman-Greek physician of the 2nd century AD, who was one of the most prolific writers in ancient literature. And it was because of Galen's advocacy for Hippocrates' views that I think Hippocrates' reputation as a certain kind of healer who practiced this idea of humoral balance, who took moderate interventions in disease, all the other things that we attribute to Hippocrates' medicine, all those other things, can probably be ascribed to Galen's influence.
Did Galen, like Hippocrates, make a separation between medicine and surgery? Because I noticed, for example, in the Hippocratic Oath, which you say may or may not be Hippocrates himself, but it says, "I will not cut for stone, even for patients in whom the disease is manifest. I will leave this operation to be performed by practitioners, specialists in this art."
Hard to know. There is no occupational distinction either in Hippocrates' time. Just to be clear, Hippocrates lived in the late 5th century BC. That would be 425 or so. Galen lives between 120 and 200 AD. So Galen already lives hundreds of years after Hippocrates. Hard to know. There's no clear occupational distinction. There's no guilds. There's no licenses. But there would be people who would be known to be more expert cutters than others. It's possible that the oath alludes to that. We do know that there are treatises written around the time of Hippocrates on the treatment of wounds, on how to do fancy bandaging. So it's not that the Hippocratic practitioners never did anything we would call surgery.
By the time we get into, if I'm not jumping too far ahead, by the time we get into New Testament times, do we see this kind of branching out of what we'd call conventional surgery versus faith healing? I mean, is there an overlap there?
There's already a good deal of religiously or spiritually motivated healing throughout history. And so one finds more naturalistic approaches coexisting very easily alongside religiously or spiritually motivated approaches, so that one of the largest healing cult in the ancient world was the cult of Asclepius, which was practiced by the sufferer going into the temples and being treated by the priests. And that would usually involve a dreamlike situation where the god Asclepius would come and take out the tapeworm or restore your sight. Some of the healings, and they range all over the place, some of them are purely miraculous. Some of them are very naturalistic. Asclepius comes in, he opens you up, he takes out the tapeworm, he charges his fee, and he goes away. And what we know about this is because of a series of tablets found in one of the temples in the ancient world, in Epidaurus. And these tablets resemble something of the healing testimonies of Lourdes, right, where people put these things up. And the Hippocratics are sometimes seen as competitors to the Asclepians, but there's no evidence that that was true, that there would be an easy passage between giving someone something for a headache and having them go to the temple. So those practices coexist all the way back, as far as we can tell.
any early evidence of quacks and sort of a knowledge of quackery?
Absolutely.
Well, when the patient dies, you might attribute it to quackery, rightly or wrongly.
There's plenty of evidence of quackery. One of the problems, so one of the things that the Hippocratics do, we can tell this from their writings, is when they come into town, they put on a show. And the way they put on a show is to stage debate over medical principles. And we know this because some of the texts are obviously set up as a debate-like format. My opponent will say, that's how the text reads. So that it's clearly meant to be not a transcription, but in some sense alluding to a platform-style show. One of the ways to do this is, of course, in a world where the spoken word is very valued, the doctor or the healer will show his stuff by putting on these shows. But it's also possible that you would be charged with quackery by simply bamboozling people into thinking you're any good. And then when it comes to actually giving you stuff or telling what's wrong, they don't know what they're doing. So that problem is always present, and it's always a kind of shadow that the healer in the ancient world has to combat.
Are there schools for learning medicine? I mean, where do you find the first medical schools?
Kos, where Hippocrates' family, there was a competing school, which is alluded to on the island of Knidus, which is right next to Kos. This is, both of these are right off the southwestern coast of Turkey, what in modern-day Turkey, which at the time, of course, that was all Greek-speaking area. There's, by the time you get to the time of Galen, Galen can enumerate several competing schools of healers and denounce them all because no one has ever been as good a healer as Galen. And again, that's a kind of brand identity, right? That there's a way of setting yourself off in this very competitive environment by saying, this is what we think is going on. This is our way of doing it. We cultivate theory. We cultivate deep empirical knowledge. We completely swear off theory. There's all sorts of ways of positioning yourself.
Did Galen have any breakthroughs other than sort of what might be called the promulgation or the dissemination of his information? Did he actually have any, to his own credit, medical breakthroughs?
Not to my knowledge. What Galen did best, he was a superb anatomist. And I don't mean – he couldn't do human anatomy. There was a window for doing human anatomy about 300 years before Galen's lifetime.
You mean where it was not considered the wrong thing to do?
Correct. There was in the city of Alexandria in the 3rd century B.C., this is about 200 years after Hippocrates, there was human anatomies were clearly done, and a great number of interesting discoveries were made about, say, for example, the retina of the eye and so on. That window closed, and by Galen's time, it was forbidden to do human anatomy. But what Galen could do was a lot of comparative anatomy. And so he dissected Barbary apes. He dissected all sorts of animals. And he showed his skills as an anatomist by putting on big public demonstrations. So Galen's very good at drawing medical theory together. And his articulation of medical theory becomes a sort of dominant theme for medical theory for more than a millennium afterwards. So that's really his most important contribution.
And what sort of social status did he have? If you had to rank Galen next to doctors, ministers, teachers, barbers, so where did he fall in terms of how people would have regarded his profession?
It's a little hard to know. Galen talks about himself endlessly. And yet the other documents from his lifetime are quite sparse on Galen. So, but what we do know is that Galen was personal physician to the Emperor Marcus Aurelius. That means he must have been quite elevated. We know from his own statement of his cases that he treated other prominent figures in Rome, such as the philosopher Eudemus, who was very socially elevated. So Galen seemed to have moved in pretty elevated circles. Also, he was a Greek. He was from Western Turkey as well, in Rome. And at the time he was there, he was a society doctor because the Romans thought, if it's Greek, it's got to be good. And a little bit of cultural envy of the sort that Americans would have for, British royals, for example, to take a contemporary example. So, yeah, Galen was fairly socially elevated.
And where do we then start seeing progress in what we think of today as our, if not perfect, our enlightened understanding of either the body or the way to treat it? We're in the 2nd century A.D. with Galen.
It's I guess I would want to ask what sorts of criteria we'd want to put on progress. And the reason I say that is because I think if one looks over the long history of medicine, one sees that there is an accumulation of knowledge about the body which goes on over the whole time. But what's interesting in that whole, so that we clearly know more about the body than Galen did. I don't think anyone would deny that. But what happens is that our view of how the body works has changed so radically that it's almost incomparable to just say that. And I'll give you one example. One of the most conspicuous things about ancient medicine, and one of the things I most like talking about, is that they don't expect to cure everybody. They take it as given that people are going to die. And in fact, one of the most famous and widely circulated treatises of Hippocrates is on prognosis. And what the treatise on prognosis says, it's important that the healer know the signs of impending death. Why? Because it's bad for business to predict recovery when the patient dies. That's what they say almost in those words. And B, it shows power that the physician can understand and master the situation even when the patient dies. That's a world that we don't live in anymore because we now act as if everybody ought to be cured of everything. And if someone dies, that requires alleviation. So in a view of the body where the only thing that counts nowadays, I'm exaggerating, of course, is favorable outcomes, it's very hard to compare. But already the knowledge of wider number of botanical remedies that started coming in the Middle Ages, for example, is clearly making new things available that weren't available before. Surgical techniques continue to improve. It's clear that wars are very good for teaching people how to do surgery. And that in the 30 Years' War, for example, if you just jump ahead to the 1600s, one finds a great deal of advances in how to treat wounds, how to clean out wounds, how to repair fractures.
That's always the case, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, the Civil War,
Yes. Actually, the Civil War was even, that's right, because they at the time of the Civil War, they had begun to have more useful forms of anesthesia. Just at the time, chloroform was available. So there's a real accumulation of technique. And just to go back to anatomy for a moment, that anatomical work that was done at the city of Alexandria in the 3rd century BC, very late 3rd century BC, was crucial for teaching us stuff about the body. The very earliest theories of physiology come out of that, in which the liver is assigned functions, the heart, and so on. And there is a straight line development of our understanding of the body from then till now.
And where does Vesalius fit into the story?
Well, Vesalius comes in as a self-professed renovator of surgery and anatomy in the mid-1500s. Vesalius comes in as kind of a self-conscious representative of the Renaissance. And what he wants to do is present himself as the first person to really critique Galen's anatomy. Because unlike Galen, Vesalius has the chance to work on humans, right? He can dissect humans. It's by no means common to dissect humans in the 1500s. But Vesalius clearly did do human dissection. He published one of the great works on human dissection, De Fabrica Humana Corporis, on the fabric of the human body. So he comes in as this sort of great innovator, but also someone who wants to restore the purity of Galen. So it's typical humanist, right? He wants to both supersede Galen, but also restore the purity of Galen. But more recent scholarship has shown by historians of medicine that actually there's a very important line of anatomical work that already begins in the 1200s that starts with human dissection. It's fairly rare to do it. You can only do it in February because it has to be done in winter for obvious reasons, because they don't have formaldehyde at the time. And bodies dissected in August don't smell so good. So you can't do it all that much, but there's a great deal of anatomical knowledge which is already beginning to be developed. So Vesalius comes in the midpoint of an important anatomical tradition.
So the Dark Ages, which we think of, I know it's a generalization, but we think of as having been an interruption in the knowledge that was learned and recorded in the classical era.
Yeah.
Did that affect medicine as well? Almost it sounds as if that line of thought, the progress continues uninterrupted.
In an interesting way, after the Roman Empire disintegrates in its sort of central authority around 500, the action in medicine shortly after moves into the Muslim world. And what's important for the Muslims is that they in the beginning of the 8th century, late 8th century, they begin this very active process of translation. They translate Aristotle, they translate Hippocrates, they translate Galen. And what had been in Galen this enormous number, this fantastic number of disparate writings, which are never synthesized in anything coherent, becomes a coherent science under the Muslims. And they pursue it. They develop surgical techniques. They integrate it with Aristotle's philosophy better than Galen ever had. They turn it into a real science of medicine. Plus, they also incorporate their own knowledge of botanical remedies, which Galen had no knowledge of, because the Muslims opened up more to India and China than would have been true in the Roman world. By the time then the Christians begin re-translating this stuff in around the year 1000 AD, the Muslims have enriched it in fantastic ways. And most importantly, they've turned this into this sort of coherent body of doctrine, which becomes the basis of medical teaching at the universities, which get founded in the Middle Ages.
And we'll follow physicians through history into the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
A man cannot become a competent surgeon without a full knowledge of human anatomy and physiology, and the physician without physiology and chemistry flounders along in an aimless fashion, never able to gain any accurate conception of disease, practicing a sort of pop gun pharmacy, hitting now the malady and again the patient, he himself not knowing which. Comment of, again, Sir William Osler. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Thomas Broman, and we're talking about the physician in history. What's important to know from the Middle Ages about the evolving role of both the doctor, the sort of general practitioner, and somebody who does surgery?
Well, the earliest universities begin to appear in the late 1100s. For example, in Bologna, there's also thought to be a faculty teaching medicine in Montpellier in southeastern France. And what those universities do is by providing a certain kind of acknowledged license to their graduates, create an effective separation between the educated graduate of the university who become physicians. They're actually the term doctor is not used at the time. They're called magister, masters of medicine. But doctor comes in later. And they become the degree holders, which separates them socially from surgeons. And so it's in the Middle Ages that one begins to see firm occupational distinctions being made for the first time between people who practice internal medicine and people who practice the external forms of treatment. That being said, they always leak over into each other's territory, and they're always complaining about it.
And so prominent figures in the Middle Ages are drawing from this knowledge that the Muslims have been accumulating. And when I say this, I mean in Western Europe they're drawing on it.
Correct. It gets translated back into Latin, and then the most prominent medical teachers begin working on it, developing it further. They begin incorporating it with their own sort of philosophical doctrines. So they create a real scientific or theoretical basis for medicine, which becomes essentially part of the physician's identity. The physician exists in part because the physician is the person who has command over the theoretical knowledge. And they denigrate surgeons as being mere cutters, people who just do handiwork. And don't have any real theoretical knowledge.
That's sort of funny, isn't it? The cutting can be quite demanding of precision and even some intuition, I would think.
Indeed. And surgeons will say, first of all, they have a theory, right? They're competing for the theory game as well. The surgeons also claim that they have more skill than the physicians, and they claim they're more useful than the physicians, because whereas the physicians just give you sort of aimless things, the surgeon can always show the effects of what the surgeon has done. The surgeon has bound a wound. The surgeon has cut out for the stone. The surgeon by that time is beginning to do various kinds of superficial surgeries for abscesses and so on. So surgeons can do a lot, and they can show the results in ways that physicians sometimes can't.
And where do you start to see the kind of specialization where you've got cardiologists and pulmonologists and people who are specializing in one organ in particular or studying it the way we think of William Harvey and the heart?
Well, you're already seeing some surgical specialization probably in antiquity, where there would be people called lithotomists who are responsible for cutting for the stone. And in fact, because you have to do it quickly and because it's, you have to know where you're going in the body, you don't want to just be stabbing in blindly. You get some surgical specialization, but the kind of specialization you just talked about is really something that you see in the early 20th century. And that has to do with the way that hospitals get integrated into medical teaching. So that's sort of part of a different story.
And where do we find most of the physicians if we go back to the early Middle Ages? Are they in the universities? Are they in the courts? Or are they just out there among the public, you know, making what shekels they can?
No, most of the – there are relatively few – people who graduate from the universities with this title, they tend to stay in the larger diocesan town. They tend to go where the money is. So you find them in the university towns, Bologna, Paris, Oxford, or London, which isn't a university town but is the seat of a court. They tend to go where the money is. And that's because there's a social hierarchy of wealth that one would expect to get from the practice of medicine. But surgeons try to do that too, right? They're defining themselves against a lower status occupation, namely the barbers, who do superficial bloodletting, who actually scrape off eczema and so on, things like that. So there's a very interesting game of social hierarchy being played.
Do we have a sense that the best physicians end up in the courts? Notable cases where the physician succeeded or failed with royalty, where the pressure would really be on?
There are certainly cases of physicians losing favor because they were unable to cure someone, and conversely, succeeding because they did succeed. One very good example of someone who succeeds quite spectacularly is Vesalius. Vesalius is both a doctor and an anatomist surgeon. He is qualified as both. That's why he can do the dissections he does. Shortly after publishing his great work in 1543, he accepts the position as personal physician to the Emperor Charles V of the Holy Roman Empire. This is the guy who controlled everything from Spain to Austria. I mean, he had a vast empire. This is arguably the leading role for a physician in the entire world. And Vesalius got it because he was a well-known, educated guy.
And how do you do?
Charles V lived for a number of years afterwards. But there was he wasn't called in for any particular reason. Remember that part of the reason for appointing these people is simply to show your power by having people in your retinue. And that was true in Galen's time as well. I said he was a personal physician to Marcus Aurelius. It's not clear he was called in for emergency surgery. He was just part of his retinue.
There. Yeah. And are there any physicians we should know about in particular between Vesalius and someone like Sir William Osler that I've been quoting?
Well, more than you want to hear. William Harvey, who lived in the 1620s, 30s, and 40s, discovered the circulation of the blood, trained in Italy, trained in techniques of anatomy, but qualified as a physician, is very well known to many people. There's a number of other famous physicians. Probably the most famous physician before the time of Osler is actually, I'll say, not a physician at all, and that's Louis Pasteur, who was a chemist. Pasteur is famous in the mid-19th century for having been one of the founders of the germ theory of disease, which really had a tremendous effect on medical practice. So although Pasteur himself was not a physician, he became interested in medical problems, and he became interested in the role of these little living contagions or germs in disease.
Did that germ theory have to wait for the invention of a microscope?
The microscope certainly helped because it allowed you to identify different kinds of organisms. But it also had to await a number of other interesting developments. Just one I'll mention by another physician from the period you just asked about, Edward Jenner, the English healer in the 18th century, introduced a method of smallpox vaccination that became adapted by many people. It caught on very slowly because the idea of giving
someone... You've got to be pretty brave.
Indeed, it's counterintuitive to give people a disease to protect them from a disease. And so you have to kind of... It's very hard to get inside the mentality that would make that acceptable.
It's still counterintuitive.
It is, and people resist it for a whole lot of reasons. But what Jenner's technique does is show that disease can be both caused by, or it adds weight to the argument that it can be caused by and protected against by specific agents, so that instead of disease being merely an issue of balance or imbalance, as it was in Hippocratic thinking, Now there is a much stronger emphasis, and you see this in the 19th century in all sorts of ways, on disease as a very specific agent, which is a foreign agent. It comes in and it makes you sick.
And what difference did that make to the role of the doctor? Once you have a germ theory of disease, how does it change sort of the way they operate?
In the short term, very little, because most doctors are not dealing with infectious diseases. They're dealing with upset stomachs. They're dealing with headaches. They're dealing with all sorts of stuff. Tuberculosis is very difficult to treat, and it was very common in the 19th century. What happens, though, is what the germ theory ends up doing is it associates the doctor with this very high profile and high status laboratory medicine. And I think if you want to ask where does the promise of science as delivering us from the evils of illness, where that idea comes from, it comes from the germ theory. Not because the germ theory actually delivered on the promise, but because the germ theory creates that promise. And there's a huge amount of buzz about it. Pasteur's treatment, just to give you one great example, Louis Pasteur discovers a way of alleviating rabies for the bite of – now, hydrophobia, the disease that's caused by the bite of a rabid dog, was thought to be almost uniformly fatal. And Pasteur, although he could – the microscope couldn't help identify the agent of rabies because it's a virus and it was too small to be seen. Nevertheless, through careful experimentation, Pasteur and his associates came up with a rabies vaccine in the 1880s. This vaccine, the treatment on the little boy who was brought to Pasteur's lab to be treated for it, made worldwide news. And we know this from newspaper accounts. Shortly thereafter, a group of boys from Newark, New Jersey are bitten by a rabid dog, and they're sent on a steamer to Pasteur. Hmm. And there are news reports from the steamer. I don't know how they did this. You didn't have radios. But in any case, the story of the boys is followed in the press. As they go to Paris, they're saved by Pasteur. And this kind of publicity just transforms what people think about medicine.
And those cures by Pasteur sound as if a lot of them were less than immediate. In other words, an advantage if you're going to treat somebody is to be there as soon as possible when this happens. But if you're talking about putting boys on a steamship.
It turns out that rabies is very slow to manifest itself symptomatically, fortunately for those boys. I think its latency period is over 2 weeks or something. So in that case, it worked. If it were something like cholera or typhus, you couldn't walk them across the Atlantic that way.
Can you say something about gender in medicine? Because we think of the doctor as male, the nurse the Florence Nightingale type as female, but some challenges are going to come along to that split. But can you talk about just sort of the tracks that men and women are on in the medical areas?
If one goes back to ancient times, there's no clear occupational distinction, and we do know of women who were known as healers. Insofar as women practiced the same kind of trades that men did, they could also have practiced healing. The same would be true in the Middle Ages as well. There are examples of women who were accused of charlatanry, who were well-known, and in fact, in some case, one case in particular, one well-known case in Paris in the 15th century, one well-known and beloved healer who was prosecuted by the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Paris for unlicensed medical practice. However, women do not become physicians. They are not allowed to go to universities with a couple. I can count on one hand all of the exceptions between the founding of universities in 1800. So that women are disabled from having the most elite status as healers. What happens during the 19th century, and especially toward the end of the 19th century, is that the hospitals, which themselves are institutions that date back to early Middle Ages, are being mobilized for centers of more sophisticated and invasive forms of medical care. And in order to do that, they need a trained staff. And the trained staff is provided by women. And the breakthrough that Florence Nightingale represents is to make nursing, which used to be a working class, a kind of low status occupation, Florence Nightingale makes it acceptable to middle class women. It becomes a calling for a woman to do something which is going to be sort of a healing angel and all that kind of thing. Most of my students certainly and most of your listeners won't know, but there was a bunch of books for girls about a figure named Cherry Ames when I was a kid. Cherry Ames was one of these books about a nurse. And each book is Cherry Ames in a different situation. So she's a student nurse, or she's an army nurse, or she is a boarding school nurse, or a dude ranch nurse, and so on. And it's not a lot about medicine. It's mostly about Cherry Ames finding love in one way or another in these sort of ways that books were written in the 1960s. But I think what's interesting is it was about a kind of occupation which a girl in that age could envision having. And it's only in the last 40 years that women have really had almost equal opportunities to get into all areas of medicine.
What about Elizabeth Blackwell?
Only an exception. I don't know much about her biography, but she was one of the most prominent female graduated physicians in 19th century America. I believe she took her degree in Zurich, someone who's listening may correct me. And Zurich was one of the very few universities anywhere that allowed women to study as full equal
Once we
members.
Get to Pasteur and, well, even before that, the invention, the creation of the smallpox vaccine mm-hmm. and this theory that germs cause so many of these diseases, is it really just a kind of almost a free-for-all to find the agent of any given disease? I mean, cholera, yellow fever, is the race on all over the world?
It is absolutely on. And before answering that, let me just give you a tiny bit of background, which is that in the 19th century, the reason why germ theory begins to make so much sense is twofold. One is the massive urbanization that one sees makes the sort of the world that made sense for humoral medicine, namely rural society, people exposed to the elements, it no longer makes as much sense. Secondly, the 19th century is faced with these dreadful epidemic diseases, cholera, typhus, typhoid fever, tuberculosis. And those are all diseases which are hard to control and which clearly seem to be related to people living together. So the disease becomes this big social problem. And it requires sanitation. It requires more sophisticated forms of epidemiology, and that's the world in which the germ theory makes sense. Once these germs started being identified, then Pasteur and his associates and their great competitor, Robert Koch, the German physician, begin racing around trying to identify disease germs for cholera, tuberculosis, diphtheria, typhoid fever, bubonic plague, and on and on. And they literally race around the world chasing after diseases to identify the bug responsible for it.
And in some cases experimenting. Yellow fever, the solution to that involve some actual volunteers, I guess,
yes.
who were infected with the disease?
Yes. I think those were the experiments conducted by the American Walter Reed
yes.
in Cuba. And what happened is when the Americans found themselves in Cuba during the Spanish-American War, they found that they were very susceptible to yellow fever. And they began trying to clean up the general environment, that is getting rid of standing water, eliminating places where they thought – remember, they weren't sure whether the water was itself the source of a germ or whether it was simply bad water, this older idea that environmental toxins are bad for you. And then later they – performed these experiments with screening, and that's when they identified the mosquito as this vector for the yellow fever.
Before we get to our own times, some sort of modern questions of medicine, what about concepts of treating the poor back in early times, you know, people who could not pay for medical care?
Physicians were often treating people all up and down the scale. And while they were in the household or in the retinue of a prominent person, a bishop, for example, or a prince, they might well also make themselves available to treat the poor. And so, and in a world where there were relatively few fixed fees, it was easy to accept payment appropriate for the person's station. Now, for the most part, the poor went to people in their communities who might have been a midwife, a surgeon, an apothecary, that is someone who compounds drugs. So they wouldn't have necessarily gone to a physician, but the physicians were available where they could be contacted. There was also a practice that was prominent, especially in Germany, of appointing what was called poor doctors in towns. And those were people paid by the municipality to care for the poor. So that tradition goes back a long way.
Well, we've looked at the concept of the humoral body and the perspective of the, we'll call it anatomical or morphological body, and we'll follow the thinking into contemporary times with what we call, it sounds a little pessimistic, the infected body when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. Never has the outlook for the profession been brighter. Everywhere, the physician is better trained and better equipped than he was 25 years ago. Disease is understood more thoroughly, studied more carefully, and treated more skillfully. The average sum of human suffering has been reduced in a way to make the angels rejoice. Diseases familiar to our fathers and grandfathers have disappeared. The death rate from others is falling to the vanishing point, and public health measures have lessened the sorrows and brightened the lives of millions. The vagaries and whims, lay and medical, may neither have diminished in number nor lessened in their capacity to distress the faint-hearted who do not appreciate that to the end of time people must imagine vain things, but they are dwarfed by comparison with the colossal advance of the past 50 years. The enthusiastic tracking of medical advance by William Osler, who was a late 19th century physician and clinician from Canada. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Tom Broman, who is telling us about the physician in history. And now we come to, let's say, the 20th century, probably the 21st, too, before we're done. And what does this phrase mean, the infected body?
It seems to me that in the wake of the discovery of the germ theory, physicians begin to think about the body in a dominant model of suffering from the infections of external agents. Now, in saying that that's the dominant model, I don't want to suggest that they ever give up the older ideas of, say, nutritional balance. I mean, there's lots of things that make us sick. But what's interesting in history is that we tend to shape our medical thinking in terms of certain dominant diseases. So, for example, if you jump ahead to today, one of the diseases that really shapes our thinking about the body is autoimmunity. And more recently, one might also think of cancer, that the way cancer represents a kind of body gone awry metabolically and in terms of its cell division. Those become kind of the models in which people do a lot of their thinking about what it means to be ill. In the late 19th century, it was germs and infection.
What about mental health? We haven't talked about sort of the psychiatrist, the Freud, the relationship between, you know, a psychiatric doctor and other forms of the profession.
That's always been somewhat on the side of medical practice in general, in part because in the 17th and 18th centuries, medicine always had to deal with, on the one hand, the possibility of issues of spiritual possession. So that would make them interface with religious figures a little bit. But even more importantly, there are lots of legal issues having to do with mental illness. In the 17th century, there's already developments in France that have people being forcibly institutionalized for mental illness. Those arguments continue in the 18th century. But one of the things that's interesting about mental illness as part of the history of medicine is that there's always a dialogue going on for centuries over whether mental illness is caused primarily behaviorally or whether it's caused by organic physical dysfunctions which have psychic knock-on effects, which they're still arguing about
say,
today.
Yeah, that dialogue sounds very much with us.
There's no way of resolving that definitively because it depends on the illnesses you're looking at and it depends on the phenomena you're most interested in. And I'll be arguing about that 200 years from now. Historians hate predicting, but that's when I'd feel safe.
So are we still largely in this mode that seems to have come upon us in the late 19th century with looking for the infectious agent for any given disease?
No. I would say not because medicine has been so successful in controlling most of the truly dreadful infections that we have suffered from. It's been a long time since we've had a horrific outbreak of anything. AIDS is indeed a horrific disease from the last 25, now almost 30 years. But AIDS is nothing like tuberculosis, nothing like cholera, nothing like the horrible diseases of the 19th century. It may be more people have suffered from it, but that's only because the population of the world today is so much larger. So those infectious diseases no longer really figure our mentality as much as they used to.
So where is the, no pun intended, cutting edge?
Diseases of aging. Cancer is a huge problem now. One of the most interesting problems is that when you start eliminating infectious diseases as things that take people off before their time, what's left are the diseases that don't take people off before their time.
But take them off.
One of the most interesting things that I find in teaching this course is that we seem to have come to a point where we expend tremendous resources on making sure that no one ever dies of anything. And I never hear anywhere in the public media a discussion of whether we ought to be doing that. It's not that we want to be callous and let people die, but should we be devoting all of this research effort to sort of these increasingly sophisticated and difficult techniques?
Well, you do have your Kevorkians.
Yes, but they're very much the exception. And one of the And I'm not giving a fair characterization ever either, because, of course, one of the things that one sees very recently is the evolution of hospice care and realization. And there's now a specialization in geriatric medicine, which is a very recent specialization that comes out of internal medicine. And what geriatricians do is really understand that their job is to make the last part of life worth living. But the geriatric physicians I've known and talk to understand that they're not saving anyone from death, that that's not their job. And so there are things that are going against it, but we still devote an awful lot of effort to making sure that no one ever dies of anything.
Most physicians that I know, including one I'm married to, complain a lot about the intersection of medicine with business, the fact that if you make medicine something where you can make money off it, where certain procedures generate more money, where some people have money to pay for medicine and others don't, that it changes the whole nature of the profession. How did we get to that point?
That is a very interesting question. It has a couple of roots that I think are worth pursuing. One is the idea that illness is a social problem. In the ancient world, the idea that society as a whole ought to be concerned about taking care of illness is just not present. You have some welfare institutions. Middle Ages is where this problem begins, and it begins with the Black Death. To control epidemic disease and to care for the consequences of that epidemic disease, one begins to see institutions put in place to ensure the public's health. By the 19th century, when we have this massive urbanization and massive problems with epidemic disease, then one begins to see real investments in sanitation, in a provision of clean water systems, and those are very expensive.
Well,
that's one route.
And also, I would think that the advances in high-tech and highly expensive diagnosis and treatment, whether you're just looking for a level of comfort or to save the person from death, is another issue that involves business.
That is the other route. Once people go into hospitals to receive the fruits of this new scientific care that's being trumpeted about by William Osler, for example, in the early 20th century, hospitals start becoming horrifically expensive, and they have to start advertising themselves to patients in order to get paying customers. Remember, they're traditionally charitable institutions, but their endowments no longer suffice to take care of the needs. The people are being treated by x-rays. They're getting laboratory studies, whether they need them or not, still the case. They're getting more sophisticated forms of surgery. Those surgical rooms have to be kept clean. It starts becoming very expensive, and there's already a business growing up around the provision of those services and equipment. That's already happening in the 19-teens and 20s, and nothing has changed in the 20th century since then to change it.
Where does medical insurance come into the picture?
At exactly the time I'm talking about, the first mass medical insurance program is passed in Germany by Bismarck, the Chancellor Bismarck, in the 1880s. It's a way to buy peace for the working classes who otherwise were fomenting political revolution. The problem of paying for illness is a problem which is already recognized in the early 20th century as a problem which is a social problem and not just a personal problem. And society has to address it because society, according to the thinking of the time, and it's one I think we probably still agree with today, society has an interest in keeping its working classes healthy because it keeps the economy going.
We talked about earlier the split between physicians, internal medicine doctors, and surgeons who were cutters, and the fact that it used to be that surgery was looked down on a little bit. But these days, the surgeons are often the highest paid physicians, and the ones that are just doing general practice are paid less. Can you say something about the different areas of medicine and the way, if you follow the dollar, we are making some judgment calls.
Yes. Surgery becomes the high-status form of medicine once you have both anesthesia and antiseptic techniques. That means by the 1880s and 1890s, guys like the Mayo brothers start pulling out gallbladders and throwing them in their backyard at a very fast rate. And they're not quacks. They were leading figures in the surgical profession. Surgeons, once they have a chance to do this, they can be more invasive. They can develop more techniques. And because they're more invasive and they can treat things which never could have been treated before, such as heart problems by the time you get to the 1960s, they are the high-status practitioners. The other high-status practitioners are the ones that are most techie. So, for example, radiologists make scads of money, and radiologists make their money because they – well, I'm sure radiologists would say differently, but part of the reason why is because they work with the fanciest gadgets, that they have the most high-tech gadgets.
Would that could you argue that because they work with the most high-tech gadgets, they have the most invested in training?
Undoubtedly, that's true. I don't know enough about a radiologist's training to really speak about that. But there's no question that the parts of medicine which have the most sophisticated techniques and gadgets to work with are the ones that tend to be the most well-paid. By contrast, the ones that aren't well-paid are the ones that most look like traditional practice. Pediatrics, for example, family medicine, are the ones that have a whole lot of continuity with the way that those fields were practiced 50 years ago. Not to say they don't know new things about childhood diseases, but it's still about giving a kid a shot and looking in their ear to see if there's an infection.
Who invented malpractice insurance?
Oh, there was malpractice as soon as there were legal suits. But I don't know the exact origin of the insurance for itself. The insurance industry goes back to the Middle Ages, but yeah, that'd be a good question. But I think the thing that's so conspicuous about medicine today is just how incredibly expensive it is. And we seem only to be trying to manage the expenses rather than asking, are there ways we could deliver care in less sort of ways that would pile up the cost so much?
And are there some that are speaking in eloquent ways in the 20th and 21st century in terms of the ethics of medicine? I think of Albert Schweitzer, for example, but I can't think of sort of modern voices that are kind of speaking out the way an Osler did, or maybe the way Hippocrates or Galen or Vesalius might have, in terms of the role of physicians.
Well, the Abraham Verghese, who was an immigrant to the United States, an Indian immigrant, has written a number of interesting things about the kind of medicine that we ought to be practicing. Another person who's been very influential recently on health policy questions is Atul Gawande in The New Yorker, who's written a number of great articles on all aspects of medicine. And he is himself a practicing physician, but he's kind of moved a little bit into the policy edge, policy side of things. I don't see anyone really representing a powerful vision for medicine of the sort that Osler represented 100 years ago. But it's possible I'm forgetting someone.
And if not, maybe we will.
Yeah.
Tom Broman has been our guest for this hour, scampering through some 2,500 years or so of medical history with us and giving us a little glimpse into the future, too. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Year.